please, there is an explanation in easy way for an average person to understand how the gold was made. So we don't really very much care how accurate is this description. At least we know where it comes from. Back to you.
Yeah, but you're presenting his story as disproving that, not proving it.
That is correct. What I'm saying is I'm trying to find something in the middle between the quoting the transcript of the video and that what I found in the articles and that what you say. Like you were talking about the spooky action at the distance, that was your opinion. But the fact of two successful experiments were not mentioned by you. So at least I found that you didn't have too much experience with that information. And always when I talk to you, I hope that you can enlighten me in areas that I have not enough of knowledge. Back to you.
AC2GS. I think that NOVA was published about 5-6 years ago. It probably goes back to an experiment of 10 years ago. Like I said, I don't think it's that special, personally. You might think it's that special. NOVA might think it's interesting to produce. But, okay, fine, wonderful. It doesn't prove what you kind of intimated it proved. It just suggested that you can maintain a bit of information on entangled quantum particles for a longer time / distance. That's kind of what it really did prove. Not any of the quantum computers, not any of the other things that you might have suggested. And I totally forget what... The point of this weird guy's comment was that this is why we think gold is produced in neutron star collisions, but we only have one other collision and it didn't show that, so let's throw that entirely out, which is not really the case. People are just going to scratch their head and figure out why we don't have repeated neutron star collisions. Maybe the number of neutron star collisions happened much more frequently, 1 billion or 2 billion or 5 billion years ago. There's a whole bunch of possible reasons for why those neutron collisions can still be a major cause for the production of gold in the universe, but it wouldn't sound as clicky as saying that, I wonder if we don't know how neutron star collision frequencies work through time. Because that would be too technical and too accurate, actually. Then we're all wrong. We don't know what we're talking about. Which you know, another guy who maybe should go back to school.
Yeah, to summarize the discussion, gold is the element of periodic table components. So my question to you, just for curiosity, is it looks like everything that is universe is on the Earth, at least at some quantity, and not much new could be found. But do you believe that all periodic table components, apart from those predicted still to be found, are found? And there's nothing new that could amaze us that we didn't know about, effectively.
Not quite sure what that question was, AC2GS. The periodic table contains empty boxes that haven't been filled. Are we going to discover elements that fit in those boxes? I think we will. Are they stable materials that last after a few seconds? No. I think The reason why those elements are not detectable anywhere is because their half-lives can sometimes be measured in microseconds or femtoseconds even. They're very unstable elements. So I think there are other elements to be discovered. For years, it will get more and more difficult because the amount of energies needed to produce them and the half-lives will be so short that the detection methods have to be rather clever. But I do think there are other people out there who are going to discover at least a few more elements on the periodic table. None that will be of any use to anyone because, like I said, they're completely unstable.
The reason of my question was because Moon is expected to have 61 million metric tons of gold. And what is believed based on collected data, at least NASA scientists speculate that a significant amount of gold underneath the moon's surface has been delivered by asteroids in the ancient past. So it's not deep there and doesn't have to be much digged for. And they say that satellite imaging has shown that top 10 centimeters, 2.5 centimeters is 1 inch. So it's a few inches. Moon soil, there's 100 times more gold than in the richest mine on the Earth. Let me jump. So it's like if you were there, you just put your finger a little bit more deep in the sand, and then you have gold there. Okay. I'm humoristic today. But anyhow, I wanted to find out what you think our research for other solar bodies or bodies in space is gonna give us a knowledge about something that was not discovered on the Earth, or the periodic table component is complete. We have empty spaces, but it's complete in its structure. Thank you.
Well, like I said before, all the stable elements we've discovered, and their specimens on the Earth, it's the unstable ones that are problematic. So, you know, you're not going to find any plutonium unless you make it, because it's just over the billion of years that the Earth has been sitting here, it's decayed away. So, again, the meteors and such will have the same elements that we know of. They're not going to have highly unstable ones with half-lives of femtoseconds. So the periodic table, as far as stable elements, is most likely completed. Chemists and physicists would be flabbergasted if they found a stable element, past the discovered numbers with higher atomic weights. It just doesn't look like it's a viable thing. So the problem has always been not that there's useful minerals and such out in outer space. It's the cost of getting them. Until or unless we discover a new mode of propulsion that's revolutionary, it's just too expensive. It's cheaper and more likely to return an investment with Earth-based gold under any refining situation. You know, unless gold goes up in price to $1 billion, then maybe you might have a good business plan.
Our travel to asteroids, I assume, is because we want to find out what we can do with it if it starts to create number 7 extinction on the Earth. So there were 6 extinctions. The the Judgment Day, we could use this kind of mythology in the earth till now, and 10% of everything that is alive now is the 10% from the last extinction, not 10% from the first extinction. So each extinction was about 90% of it. But anyhow, if we go to the moon, we may think it's so close and maybe it is worth to go there, although we know that there is no atmosphere on it. But the question is, why do we do that? If everything that is in space is also in the earth, why do we need to spend that money? For life, carbon, oxygen, potassium, and sulfur is important. They are the higher list of the favorites. Not the gold. So, what are we looking for?
Scientists are doing most, if not all, of this stuff for discovery, to figure out more about these places, what it's made of, how it formed, what's gone on in all these years. So that's where most of the legitimate work is being done. This sky in the pie in the sky thing about terraforming Mars. I don't want to certainly go into he who will be remain nameless of putting 1 million people on Mars in 20 or 30 years. Now, that's nonsense. It would cost hundreds of trillions of dollars to even begin to terraform Mars. And, you can set up little base stations on the moon, but those are little base stations and they're highly dependent upon the Earth shuttling materials back and forth. It's just not viable. You have to kind of try and make the Earth as best you can. You know, again, maybe someday we'll have terraforming technology that we can't even imagine, but right now we don't. And poor schnooks who think that they're going to go to Mars and have a nice long life there, unless there's a massive infrastructure shuttling stuff back and forth between the two planets and nothing goes awry on the Earth. If anything goes awry on the Earth and the umbilical cord is broken, those guys are dead. So I think that's good PR again. It makes for good books, that people will buy the books, read the newspapers, the magazines, click on the websites, look at the YouTube. But ultimately, I think the scientists are much more interested in the findings for these projects as opposed to getting someone to set up a farm on Mars.
When I'm looking at the mystery of gold, I'm thinking that it took so much time to the human being, and then only in 20th century it was unable to unravel the mystery between iron, silver, copper, brass, and the colors due to reaction with oxygen. So oxygen is always hungry for the electrons. Iron will give up two or three electrons to oxygen and will oxidize it. So we have a rust as a result of it. But other elements also fall victim of the oxygen, not gold. So the gold is not the most non-reactive of all metals because it refuses to share electrons with oxygen. So the question is, how that affects our life? Why people pressure it so much? Back to you.
Okay, there's a whole bunch of different reasons. It really goes into economics as much as anything else. You have a particular thing. It has a particular scarcity, and it has a particular set of uses. If you increase the scarcity, the price goes up. If you increase the number of uses, the price goes up. as economics. Gold is a relatively inert metal. It does not corrode. It has a interesting, unique yellow gold luster, which people like. And when it's pure gold, it's somewhat malleable. You can do all kinds of things. You can also add different alloys like silver and such and harden it up a bit. This jewelry is almost never 24 karat pure gold. It's 18 or 16 or 14, which makes it much less malleable. It's also a decent conductor. It's not as good a conductor as silver. Silver is the best elemental conductor we have, and copper is the second. Gold is just the third. But again, it's non-corrosive, so people kind of like to coat electrical equipment in it. And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of different uses for gold, but it's relatively scarce, even though there are tons and tons and tons of it. You know, of all the discovered gold, if you handed it out to everyone in equal amounts, most people would not be terribly thrilled with the amount that they would get. So that's more of an economics question than it is a chemistry question. Chemistry's been going good for the last 200 years. Before that, unfortunately, we had to deal with alchemy. And the atomic theory of chemistry had its origins 2,000 years ago in Greece. So, you know, I mean, we work slowly, but fortunately we keep working on it.
Thank you for that comment. In addition to that, I can say that in 2011, the Barrick Gold Corporation in Nevada processed millions of tons of ore. We should use the word stone, rock, not ore, to recover just 4 million ounces, which is only 125 tons of gold. So probably if something is not that very much present around, it has a value. So that would be not only gold. Anything that is rare has a value. Am I right?
Well, I mean, to a degree, everything has a value. It might be incredibly close to zero, but that's still a value. So, but again, the forces of economics is that if something is all over the place, then you might find someone who's real lazy, who can't be bothered to bend over, and, you know, he'll give you a penny or two to bend over for him. So, you know, it's worth something, but not much. But as opposed to something where you have to basically cut a big piece of a mountain up and slice it up into little fragments and run it through a bunch of noxious chemicals that leave contaminants all over the place, then you can charge a lot more, but only so much. I am sure that if the price of gold quadrupled, production in places would increase because it would be cost-effective, because as you increase, you know, scrape it away at lower and lower yield ores, the return on investment gets lower and lower as well.
Yeah, at the end of that discussion about the gold, I can say that that's what I have in the screen in front of me. It says about 1.6 quadrillion tons of gold in the core. So now we're not talking about the layers, but we're talking about the core. So if we were able to take it out, we would be able to create 16 inches, which is 40 centimeters thick layer of gold around the earth. Unbelievable. Thank you very much for that. I have a ham radio related, but I believe that I was so long allowed to talk, and there are other people who want to talk too. The ham radio related is about underground antenna, so we're talking about a piece of wire that is buried totally underground and is grounded from both sides. And some of those antenna operate from 9 kilohertz to 50 megahertz. And there are the particular types of the antennas in the article. known also to the ham radio operators, but since they're too worried, they don't have the time to get into that, I think it would be the best if we leave it for next week. Back to you, Dr. Roy. Thank you very much.
AC2GS. Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, we kind of go back to this a lot of times, and, you know, I even to the point where I don't really feel comfortable telling the story once again that, you know, guys who are interested in this in amateur radio are called loafers, and since my last name is Laufer, I've always kind of thought it's a shame that I'm not more interested in the subject, involved in the subject. But, you know, yeah, I think I've done that semi-joke about 10 times. All right, thank you, Wesley, once again, as always, for participating. We've been having some slow Sundays here. So, once again, I'm AC2GS. We still have some time for the technical net, if you are so inclined. So, if you have any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk.
WB2BXO, if there's no one else in here. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Frank. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing pretty well, Roy. I was going to say, just as long as nobody else is in here, how'd you do on 10 meters today? I don't think I noticed any too much propagation on 10 meters. And what did you find? Go ahead.
Yeah, this was my Sunday off, but I tuned in and listened to what was going on. It was all local. There was no one that I heard that was far enough away to be even joked about being DX. Matter of fact, I heard from a guy in Queens who couldn't even hear the net. So I think the net control operator was having some mismatch problems with his antenna. So, you know, even local stations were having a somewhat hard time. It was mostly Brooklyn stations that I heard conversing with the net control operator.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, supposedly conditions are starting to improve. Sunspot numbers are beginning to go very high, but for some reason or other, it's been the case for much of this cycle. We're just not getting the kind of super-duper propagation we might expect. There was some propagation on 15. I worked VU4TMP in India on 15 meters this afternoon, but he was probably not loud enough to work with an apartment station. I was working him on a remote with, even though it's 100 watts to a dipole in a location with a very low noise level. And around sunset, there was an Israeli station on, which is at 3 in the morning in Israel. And he was also about at 3, so probably would not have been audible on an apartment station, but interesting to hear. India, I think it's about 4 in the afternoon our time, and in Israel at about 8 p.m. our time. So at least in the tropical range, with good antennas, guys are getting propagation all night. So that's kind of encouraging. Hopefully in a few weeks we'll start seeing some really super propagation. Go ahead.
Well, I certainly hope so. I remember we had similar problems last year. All of spring was really not good, and summer was awful. And, you know, into fall, got a little bit better. And then, you know, I mean, I can't remember too many other than the rare contest week where the place was buzzing all over the place. So, I'll try and stay optimistic as best I can. And see what happens in the fall, because I'm not expecting much from August, judging from the last few months that I've been looking at my Pandasat around 10 meters.
Yeah, well, I think August and March are supposed to be the best propagation months of the year during the sunspot peak. and I did catch the tail end of the super double peak in 1972 when I first got my general, and I was working working the world with a ground with a ground mounted vertical with no radios. It literally wasn't radioing very much, but I still made some amazing contacts at that time. So hopefully, you know, the predictions are that we should start getting some really good propagation maybe as soon as August. But, you know, what actually happens, I guess, remains to be seen. Go ahead.
Yeah, most of my hindsight is 20/20, but foresight, not so good. It'll be interesting to see. Like I said, it's kind of like the weather, unfortunately. You can talk about it all you want. You can make hopes and wishes and dreams come true type of thing, but it's going to be what it's going to be, and we're all going to have to settle for it one way or the other.
Yeah, well, supposedly some daily sunspot numbers are shooting up toward the 300 range. That's very encouraging, but let's see the actual propagation. And I don't know if there are really some very good explanations of why we're not getting the level of propagation you'd normally expect with those sunspot numbers. The only thought I've heard so far is the amount of frequency of solar flares. And another suggestion I heard a year or two ago was that it had something to do with depletion of the ozone layer, which was reducing the amount of polar propagation. Those are the only two suggestions I've heard of why we're not seeing some really good propagation even with some really high sunspot numbers. Go ahead.
Yeah, the ozone layer is really not a good excuse because the ozone layer is nowhere near the ionosphere. So, not really. Plus the fact that the ozone layer is probably been doing better in the last 10, 20 years than the previous 10, 20 years, you know, because we've taken a lot of those refrigerants and ozone eating molecules out of aerosol cans.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, that's just one of the theories I heard, that the ozone holes over the pole might be having some impact. But I hear what you're saying, and I was wondering about that. The ionosphere is at a level that I think most of us would ordinarily not think of the Earth's atmosphere as being several hundred miles out in space, actually. Anyway, I'll let you get on with the net. I just thought of when we had nobody else jumping in here, and I jump in with a couple of comments. WB2BX, so.
AC2GS. I do appreciate it, as always, Frank. I look forward to our little conversations here on the technical net, and your participation in it is very much appreciated. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the summer edition of the Limar Technical Net. We're still open for business. Anyone has any questions, comments, topics for discussion, we're open to hear them. So just hit that push to talk and ID yourselves. Well, here we are in the dog days of summer, and I guess people aren't talkative. We'll ask one more time. If there's anyone who has any questions or comments or topics for discussion for tonight's TechNet, please hit that push to talk and ID yourselves. Okay, well, I kind of suspected we were going to have a short session tonight. There's something going on this summer, a lot of limited use of the airwaves. I've heard it on other repeaters as well. I hope that doesn't bode unfortunate for our hobby, but we'll see what the future will bring. One last, just kind of short circuit this segment, and we'll move on to the next one. If anyone And if any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk now or forever hold your peace. Okay, unfortunately, your signal is about 80% noise. So I heard you, but I didn't quite make out much of what you said. So if you can orient your antenna or raise your output power or in any other way kind of get it a little bit stronger to the repeater, I'd appreciate it. Something like 3 times the power, so I'm not even sure if it's the same person trying to get through. So, person trying to get through, if you want to give it a try, do so, and hopefully I'll be able to hear you. Okay, I guess he's decided not to, or he has no way of boosting his power. Anyway, thanks to those who participated tonight. And for those who didn't, I don't know, maybe I should hope that your laryngitis gets better or whatever. Hopefully there'll be more participation next week's edition. So I guess we'll call an early end to this segment of my little portion of the Limark Technical Net. Paul, if you'd like to do your SpaceNet report now.
Okay, Roy, you know, maybe tomorrow's the club night, I can make an announcement. People might forget about it. You know, there's at least 50 people that check into that, so maybe we'll do that tomorrow.
Okay, very good. I see that the computer net actually sends out on their mail server the notice.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that would be good. Anyway, yeah, it's been quiet. So, I have a few topics we can cover. But if anybody that's listening, remember this is the TechNet. TechNet takes priority. You can always stop me from going on, and we can talk about antennas and power supplies and batteries. Anyway, this is Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. One wanted to discuss it. It was launched over 2 years ago and put into lunar orbit. It's called the Capstone. It has a long name. It's called the Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System Technology Operations and Navigation Experiment. So it's a long word, but, you know, Capstone is the name. It was built by Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is a company owned by Peter Beck that normally they launch a lot of these Electron rockets, you know, from two locations now. They have two launch complexes in New Zealand and another one here in the States in Wallops Island, Virginia. So they're doing pretty good. They've launched over 50 of these rockets since 2017 they started. So, you know, they also build satellites. So in this case, they built the Capstone satellite for NASA. Let me drop it. And it was launched a little over 2 years ago. It's been in orbit around the moon for that long period of time. And it's in this extremely elliptical orbit. And they did that on purpose. It's what they call a halo orbit, or a rectilinear halo orbit. That's how it started off. Now it's in a rectal. It's just extremely highly elliptical. It goes out like, you know, I guess around almost 40,000 miles away from the moon, and then comes back, goes as close as 1,000 miles to the moon. if you were to look at the moon, you know, you would see the it inscribed. Looking at you, it's not going along the ecliptic. It's in a polar orbit. So every, I think it's 11 days, it comes across either the south pole or the north pole of the moon, which will be great for communications once we have a base, you know, or we start landing on the south pole of the moon. So it was set there as an experiment to test out this particular orbit. The reason for it is that eventually, in the near future, in fact, I think within about a year and a half or so, they're going to launch the first module, actually two modules in one, of the Gateway space station. They really wanted to make sure this was a stable orbit where you use hardly any fuel to keep it where it's located. You don't have to keep adjusting the orbit, so you're going to save on fuel. The Gateway is going to have four all ion thrusters attached to it. So once in a while it'll turn that on to move it in space a little bit in case it gets a little out of whack. And you know, that'll be the Gateway space station. Eventually have like three people on there on a regular basis, you know, for maybe a month or so, and then they'll bring them back. And then they'll leave the Gateway space station to run autonomously for, you know, without a crew. So it'll be designed to do that. And that will be a location where spacecraft will eventually launch from the Earth, dock with the space station. You know, they'll be able to hang out there for a while, and then when they're ready, they're going to go into another vehicle and go down to the moon, spend, you know, days or weeks at a time, whatever it might be, and then eventually return to the Gateway space station, and then eventually go home on the Orion spacecraft all the way back to Earth. So they needed to perfect this orbit, and they needed as much information as they could. So Capstone is doing that. But one of the interesting things aboard Capstone, the small, and it's only maybe a 60-pound satellite. You know, so it's small, has little thrusters, has solar panels all over it to keep it active. So it's, you know, it's much bigger than a typical CubeSat, but it's on a small size. The instrument on board is an atomic clock that they put on board, and they know exact time, and it matched an atomic clock here on Earth, so they know the exact time between the two. But I heard here the thing is when they launch from the moon, it's in orbit around the moon with this atomic clock ticking away. The idea is to perfect navigation, and they're going to need to do this with the space station eventually. So with the Capstone satellite, that they're testing that, make sure that system works. And normally when, let's say there's a satellite out by the moon or, you know, any good distance away from the Earth, maybe Mars, Earth does is they'll send out a signal on a deep space network. It'll fly all the way to the moon and bounce off of the satellite. Not really bounce off, it'll be received by the satellite, and the satellite in turn sends it right back to Earth. And by knowing the timing and speed of light, mission control could figure out pretty exactly where this thing is in space, you know, within, you know, maybe a couple of inches all the way out by the moon, which is a good thing. But what this atomic clock does, because you know, we have a two clocks, one on Earth and one on the spacecraft. The spacecraft, all the spacecraft has to do is send a signal to Earth. And when it gets to Earth, they'll evaluate the time between the clock that's on board and the clock that's on Earth. By doing that, they can figure out exactly where it is, again, within, you know, a couple of inches. But they only need that one transmission from the spacecraft. They don't need to transmit it from Earth to hit the spacecraft and then have it... spacecraft turn around and send it back. It's just one transmission from the spacecraft. So I thought it's very innovative, and it, you know, apparently it's working. And that's the system that they'll use not only on the moon, eventually on Mars as well. You know, you can imagine going anywhere in the solar system with one of these atomic clocks, and because, you know, it's a match of, you know, of the one that you have on Earth. No matter where you go, you'll be able to just make one transmission, you know, it'll, either from Earth up to the satellite or from the satellite back down to Earth. And by knowing that, that information, with only one transmission, you can find out where you are in space and time. Any comments or questions, WSON. And by the way, they do account for relativity. There's going to be a clock. I bought this up on the net probably a month or so ago. There's going to be a lunar time, because the time on the moon is different from the time on Earth. Because of relativity, you know, 1/6 gravity actually makes a difference compared to what we have here. And that's going to be important in the future, because, you know, traveling at these speeds, I think orbital speed around the moon is 6,000 miles per hour, something like that. But whatever it is, or you might be on the way to the moon at a higher speed, you would want to know, you know, exactly, you know, your reference for a time. You don't want to go by Earth time. You might be a couple of milliseconds off at high speed, you know, might land you, you know, a crater or two away where you want to really land on the moon. So, there you go. All right, let me drop it. Here's a topic I know Wes wanted to talk about, the Viper rover system. Canceled, you know, they didn't get up to $1 billion yet in investing into it, but I think it's $800 million they've been working on it for some time. It's a rover, very large rover, you know, way on Earth, probably 1,500 pounds or so. You know, it's going to be pretty heavy, and it was designed to land on the moon, drive around, have this big drill, it's going to be able to drill 6 to 8 feet into the ground, take tests, you know, all kinds of scientific experiments were going to be done with this four-wheeled rover. They've been testing it, and it looks, you know, it's under development, and it looks pretty good. Probably would have been ready to go. Unfortunately, the lander that they were going to use, they made a deal with Astrobotic, you know, a company that has built the land. The land is different than the rocket that was going to launch it. It probably would have been launched by either a Vulcan rocket or a SpaceX rocket. Anyway, Astrobotic is the one that launched the spacecraft machines. What happened was they made it to the moon. Oh, correction. Astrobotic didn't make it to the moon. They went around the moon, came back, and burnt up in Earth's atmosphere. So it was a failed mission, and they need to work on the whole system. That's the same company that was going to launch the rover. They were building a bigger lander called Griffin, and they are nowhere near ready to do that. So NASA just scrapped the whole idea for now, which is a shame, but you know, it would have been cool. This thing was had lights on it, would have been able to drive around in the dark, you know. Looking forward to that. Unfortunately, that thing was canceled. But not to give up hope, NASA does have another mission going up at the end of this year, probably in November, and it's called the Prime One. And that thing stands for Polar Resources Ice Mining Experiment. So it's a robotic mission. It's not going to ride around. You know, it's not a rover. But once it does land, it does have all kinds of similar experiments, instruments that were on Viper, and that's going to be on this Prime mission, they call it. You know, it's a good size heavy vehicle, you know, for something like this. Heavier than the Capstone that's right, you know, going around in orbit around the moon. That thing weighed around 50 pounds. This thing weighs around 80 pounds. And it will land on the moon. It has all kinds of experiments, and it should launch on a. I believe this is going to go up on a SpaceX rocket in November. We'll see it. We'll see how it does. You know, it's not as good as the Viper. It's going to be mobile. This thing is not, but it has very similar experiments that Viper had. We'll see how it does. Any questions? Probably in September, hopefully September. The Escapade will be flying to Mars to bigger CubeSats that are going to be exploring the magnetic field, whatever magnetic field Mars might have. I know it's very small, but they want to know about it. And it's going to be, there's two satellites, one's called Blue and the other one's called Bolt, and they're identical. So we'll see how it goes. You know, as one passes and the other one, you know, in a magnetic field, the other one will pick up the same information as it passes, and they kind of get like, not quite 3D, visions of what they're looking at, but you know, something close. But to me, the interesting part of the mission is how they're going to get there. And they'll be flying on the very first New Glenn rocket, which should be ready, they say, by late September. And New Glenn is being built by Blue Origin. Blue Origin is by Jeff Bezos' fame, you know, Amazon. And he's got this massive rocket. It's going to be a two-stage rocket. It has capability of having three. But for now, it's going to have the two stages. And it's a heavy-lift vehicle, bigger than the Falcon 9 rocket that SpaceX uses. In fact, much bigger than that. Almost close to the size of the Saturn V. Saturn V was about 364 feet, I think it was, Saturn V. This thing is a little shorter, but much wider. It's got a big, wide fairing on top, maybe about 23 feet in diameter, so it could hold a lot. It's only small satellites that are going to be put on top, but, you know, this is the first flight, and they just want to test it out, but NASA's, you know, going to roll the dice and see how it goes. On this first flight, it's going to go to Mars, and these things are going to be reusable. The new blend will be able to be reused up to 20 times, is the prediction. SpaceX has built a massive floating barge, bigger than what SpaceX has. This is a much bigger rocket that's going to be landing than the Falcon 9. And it should land around 600 miles out at sea. They'll tow it all the way back. I think it's got its own propulsion, but they'll get it back to Cape Canaveral, the port anyway, and then bring it in and refurbish it. It has seven engines, seven, they call them Vulcan engines. You know, it's a new rocket, but you would say, well, you know, aren't they rolling the dice with these seven engines? No, because they have launched two of these engines previously. Blue Origin has a contract with the government, with the United Launch Alliance, I'm dropping, to launch the Vulcan rocket. Which was launched, I think, the end of last year, and it went up successfully. In fact, that was one of the ones that sent the spacecraft to the moon, and that was Intuitive Machines, and that's the one that, you know, landed on the moon but fell over. But the rocket has got seven of these BE-4 engines, similar to, they're exactly, wait, they're saying that that was launched on the Vulcan rocket, so they're not Vulcan engines, they're BE-4 engines, they call them. More powerful than the engines that SpaceX built. These things, each one has 550,000 pounds of thrust. And they're going to put seven engines on this rocket for the first stage, so it doesn't need any booster rockets attached to it. But you're going to get plenty of thrust with seven 550,000 pounds of thrust engines. It will get to orbit within 8 minutes. But after, I think, 2.5 minutes, the first stage separates from the second stage. The second stage takes over, and that has two BE-3 engines. BE-3 they use a different fuel than the first stage. First stage, they use liquid methane and liquid oxygen. And the second stage, they're using liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And the BE-3 engines are the ones that have successfully launched people into suborbital space for Blue Origin, including Jeff Bezos himself. He went up. He was happy to be one of the first people. He had a crew of like four on that flight. And then he launched six on that 16-minute flight to space. They get 4 minutes of weightlessness, and then they return to Earth. So they have plenty of experience with the BE-3 engine. They only use one BE-3 engine on that, and it's around 125,000 pounds of thrust, I think they said. So now, on this thing, they're going to use two of them. They'll actually have a capability of pushing in one or two. So it's going to be very versatile. They're thinking about having the second stage in the future become reusable as well, but not in the beginning. And the fairings themselves that open up these big, you know, you can put three city buses, in, you know, or three school buses inside the fairings. It's that big, big of a load that this thing's going to be able to take to space if they need to. Anyway, that's the story on Escapade. We'll see if that gets off the ground sometime in September and puts those satellites around. I don't know if it's going. I don't think they're going to go into orbit. They don't have enough thrust to slow stuff down. So I think it's just going to be a flyby. I'll have to check on that. Escapade. Any comments? WS2N.
Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform. Good evening, Paul. This is Charlie.
Hi, Charlie. How you doing? We're doing a space portion. I've been out a little earlier. Here we are. Do you have any comments? And if not, how are you doing?
Yes, I have one comment, and I'm doing fine. Today's the anniversary of Apollo 11. Did you mention that?
No, I didn't. Yeah, that's the 20th. Yeah, they launched on the 16th. They landed on the 20th. And Weimark, I didn't go, but they have like a special event station. They go to the Cradle of Aviation. You know, every year on this date, they go there twice a year for the Apollo landing, Apollo 11 landing, and they go for Lindbergh flight across the Atlantic. So, it was, 1969, and here we are all these years later, and since then, a total of 12 people have walked on the moon. Of course, the first two was Armstrong and Aldrin. Anyway, back to you, Charlie.
That's 55 years ago this week. When it started, we were teenagers. Now we're going past Social Security.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was 17. I remember that. And, everybody had it on in the middle of the night. It was pretty cool. And, not sure, a bunch of kids, at one of the houses, and they said, and here's Neil Armstrong. He's gonna, open the door, and he's gonna come down the ladder. And one of the kids at the, at this space party, came out with, take me to your leader. Which sounds ridiculous now, but it was pretty funny in 1969.
Yeah, I was just short of 15 when it happened. Just a couple of days short of my 15th birthday.
Yeah, there you go. But, and it's just, and they had, it's interesting. A lot of people don't think of this. Kennedy said, we're going to launch somebody to the moon and return them safely by the end of this decade. They knew they were going to, have two people do that. But it was interesting that not only did two people do it, not just one, but there was two missions by the end of the year of 1969. Apollo 12 went up soon after that, and had a Pete Conrad and Alan Bean on board, so they landed, and so, we were way ahead of schedule. They were hoping for the end of the decade. Well, not only did they get those two, they wound up with a total of four, and by the time they were done, a total of six landings with 12 astronauts that had walked on the moon successfully and returned successfully, with a collection of over 800 pounds of rock and regolith from the moon. That's collectively out of all the missions, that's what they brought back. Very valuable stuff, and it went around They gave it away to certain countries so they could experiment with it, or they could say they have a piece of the moon. Very interesting. I'd like to see that happen again. Back to you, Charles.